grab your notes. Welcome to Eastlake. I'm Robin. This is a church for everyone. That means it doesn't matter exactly what you think about God or what your background is. Everybody is welcome here. We're in a series, and it'd be nice, wouldn't it, if you didn't have to work. The money just came rolling in. We've been talking about work. How do I connect Jesus to my job? And we started out talking about it a few weeks ago, and the first thing we said is that work was designed by God to be a blessing, not just to be a toil or to get a paycheck. It was part of the plan of paradise. Now, your job may not feel like paradise. Maybe it wasn't paradise this week. But God's intention was that he'd join us at the workplace, that we'd get stuff done, and also that stuff would get done in us. Work is the place that my character changes, that I grow. How happy are you with your spiritual growth? You were just check in. How do you feel about how you're growing, where your maturity level is? A lot of that happens in the workplace. Some of the things that we don't like about the job are the exact same things that we need if we're going to grow. Each of us has an opportunity where we work to see it as a kind of private university. I attend the University of Mark Miller. I also work there, but I'm taking classes there on character development, because it's at the workplace that God joins me and does things in my life. I get things done, but also God gets things done in me. Now, you can go to our website, eastlakelive.com, and see all the talks. We have some talks about how to be a great employee, how to be a good boss. And today we're going to wrap it up talking about how do I make sure work doesn't become too important? How do I make sure work doesn't become the most important thing in my life, even more important than God? And it's the big idea this weekend. You can write, don't let the tail wag the dog, the old saying. Don't let the wrong thing in my life have power over my entire life, the job, the workplace. Don't let a portion of my life called my job have such power over my entire life. Don't let the tail wag the dog. How are you doing at your job? I'm going to talk about that today. There's a scripture I want to read to you. God wanted people to look for him, and perhaps in searching all around for him, they would find him. But he's not far from any of us. It is through him that we're able to live and do what we do and to be who we are. But it isn't always so easy. We spend a lot of time at our jobs, and our paycheck is attached to our jobs, and we see the people that we work with as much as we see anyone, and our job performance is so important. We often measure ourselves on the basis of our job, and what can happen is I can elevate work to where it's more important than friendships, more important than my health, even more important than family. I can elevate my job that it's even more important than God. And there's a place in the Bible that talks about it. It's like the Lord anticipated that the work just continues to creep and creep and creep and creep. And the problem is that the priorities at work don't always mesh so well with the priorities at home. The bottom line, competition, win at any cost. You take those same sort of priorities and you try to mix them into family or friendships. It doesn't work so well. And yet work continues to creep and creep and creep, and the tail starts to wag the dog when my job is the most important thing in my life. I measure myself on how I'm doing at work. When's the last performance review you had at your job and you noticed that based on that review is how you show up back at home that evening, because somehow my job, this one portion of my life, can have so much power over my entire life. And if I'm not careful, I can elevate it to the place where the tail is wagging the dog. Now, God knew all about this, and I want to read you something out of the Bible, how he anticipated this. There's 10 commandments in the Bible, and let me just read you the very first one. You must not make for yourself an idol of any kind or an image of anything in the heavens or on the earth or in the sea. Do not bow down to any idol or worship it, because I am the Lord your God, and I tolerate no rivals. Now, I don't know if anybody has a little statue in their backyard, probably not, where you go and you worship that or bow down to it. So you think, well, idols don't have anything to do with me. But what if it had a more everyday sort of definition? Well, what if this was the definition of idolatry? Anything that takes God's place as my provider. Then maybe the tail could start to wag the dog. I don't have a little statue that I take around with me, and I don't. But maybe if it's anything that tries to take God's place in my life because my value is found there and I measure myself with it and I look to that as, you know, work is my provision, but it's not my provider. Can it get turned around? One lady wrote this week in the e-devotionals. They're on your connection cards. You can get those. They're free. They're kind of neat to have. She put this, I've always seen myself in the workforce, but what I didn't see coming was being the primary provider for my three kids. When my marriage ended and I became a single parent, my career became many things: an emotional escape, a source of validation, an unquenchable drive to succeed in order to secure provision for my family. I excelled, I grew in knowledge, and I had new experiences and appeared to have it all together. What wasn't so apparent was the damage I was causing internally by refusing to face the darkness of my divorce and the damage I caused others as I worked with them, who I quickly viewed as pawns rather than unique people God had created. Eventually, my stoic front began to slip, and I realized I needed a new way to work and space to heal. I moved from a 70-hour week to a 45-hour work week and began to seek out in others some kind of new rhythm. My fears told me that the new way would tank my success, but instead I began to work from a place of overflow rather from a place of deficit. I was able to be more present and compassionate to others as I healed. We had a transition. You go through something in life and all of a sudden the tail starts to wag the dog. One area of my life becomes primary, and I start to see that as the definition of everything that I am and that I do. When the tail wags the dog, it means one area of my life, like my job. Your job can't be your Jesus or your Savior. It's your job. But it will wag your life if it has the power over your entire life. So what's some ways that it doesn't happen? We'll look at some questions today. Number one, your notes. Have I got my priorities in order? How do I make sure my priorities? You know, in life, the simplest things in life can get out of order and become very difficult. I brought an illustration today. What could be simpler than putting on our shoes and socks? I mean, we're little tiny children. We could go over to the nursery where they have the preschool, and most of those kids know how to put on their shoes and socks. It's simple. It's not difficult at all. It's, you know, unless it gets out of order. Because if I put on my shoe first and then I try to put on my sock, all of a something really simple becomes really difficult. And you can get really super frustrated. You put your shoe on, and someone said, it's not, just put your shoes and socks on. It's really easy. And you put your shoe on, and then you try to get your sock on. And then you think, you know, you think crazy thoughts when life is out of order and your priorities get mixed up. Sometimes you can come to the wrong conclusions. You're like, I know what I need to do. Just buy bigger socks or maybe smaller shoes. And you get more frustrated and angry. You can blame people. I told them not to buy me these shoes in the first place. I hate these socks. They shrunk them in the dryer. It's their fault. But really, it's difficult because I just have the priorities wrong. If I put my sock on first, the shoe makes sense. But if I put my shoe on and then try to put my socks on, it becomes very, very difficult. And life works that way. The tail starts to wag the dog when my priorities get out of order. And I think God was able to anticipate all of this. He created this space for us to walk into each week to reprioritize, because that's the problem with priorities. They slip and they fade, and the next thing you know, I'm pulling a sock over a shoe with all of my might, swearing under my breath, and frustrated and angry. and I can't figure out why it's not working. And I'm ready to go barefoot for the rest of my life. And really all it is things are just out of order. Now, how do you get them back into order? God created this way that this happens. It's called Sabbath. And there's a lot of misunderstandings about it, but I just want to read you something. This isn't in your notes, but I'm just going to read it out of the Bible. It'll be on the screen. Observe the Sabbath day to keep it holy. Work 6 days and do everything you need to do, but the seventh day is a Sabbath to God, your God. Don't do any work. It's like the Lord knew that work will just creep and creep and creep and take and take and take and seek to define my entire life. And pretty soon the tail is wagging the dog. Little tiny job over here controls everything about my schedule and where I place my time and how I feel about myself and who I listen to and who I don't listen to and what my future is going to be like and what my past means to me and the tail. And it's just my job. It gets out of priority. And God says Sabbath. Now, I know Sabbath is, you know, there's a lot of different things about Sabbath. What's a Sabbath? And the misconfusion about it, that it's a certain day of the week, or, you know, you have to have a certain diet for the Sabbath. And really, it's not any of those things. When Jesus came, the religious leaders had almost ruined the Sabbath because they made it into a religious requirement. And so they had these really strict rules about the Sabbath, and they created these rules, and then they also created these loopholes so they could get out of the Sabbath. I'll tell you one, it's really funny. In Jesus' day, the rule was you had to practice the Sabbath in your house, in your home. You couldn't leave your home on the Sabbath. You had to stay home. So what the religious leaders did is they said, well, your home is technically anything that belongs in your house. So they would fill up a bag with all the different things in their house, and then they would just grab the bag and they would just go do whatever they wanted around town. They'd visit people and do their shopping. And then when they'd get somewhere to have, maybe they got to go into a restaurant or a little inn and have something to eat, they would just take out something from their bag that was in their house and they'd go, technically, I'm at home. Pretty silly. And they had turned this great gift from God into a religious requirement. It doesn't matter what you eat, it doesn't matter what day you practice this on. Sabbath is an attitude. It's a space that I step into, but most importantly, it's an invitation from God to take a look at my life and my priorities and say, is the tail wagging the dog anywhere? Do I have any? Am I trying to pull a sock over a shoe? Is that what's going on? God, are my priorities out of order again? It's a regular opportunity that God invites us into to reorder things in our life. A chance to go to the Lord and just say, I want to talk to you about my life, God. I think it's disorganized and out of order. It's called Sabbath. Because work will creep and creep and creep and creep. And pretty soon, everything about me will be about my job. And you can have Sabbath whenever you want. God invites you into it. The important thing is to just focus and be with Him and let God have your attention. He'll give you His attention. And then you can just talk through your life. Reorganize some things and get your life in order. So you slip your sock on and then your shoe. So the first one is how's the priorities in my life, and do I understand Sabbath? It's an invitation from God to reorder and reprioritize my life. Number two in your notes, am I trying to prove my worth? So that's a good one with jobs. It doesn't matter if you're at school, maybe you're a student and that's your job. Maybe you work in the home and your family is your job. Maybe you work in the workplace. But the question is, am I trying to prove my worth? And here's how you know about that, is that when it doesn't go so well, how do you feel about your life? Look what the Bible says about us. We are God's masterpiece. He has created us anew in Christ Jesus, so we can do the good things he planned for us long ago. The problem is when the tail starts to wag the dog and my job, the wrong thing in my life begins to have power over my entire life, I don't feel like a masterpiece. Back when I was in college, I had written this paper for a professor, and I thought it was pretty good. And you got to meet with the professor and go over your paper. And I was looking forward to getting to meet with the professor because I couldn't wait for him to praise me in my fantastic paper that I had written. And so when I sat down with him and he pulled out my paper and the big moment had finally arrived for me to hear about how great my paper was, he didn't praise me, he corrected me. It looked like he butchered a chicken on my paper. It was so red from ink and corrections and rewrites. And then he told me, he said, do it again because it's not good enough. When is the last time, and it happens in the workplace, or something occurred and you weren't good enough? You didn't pass. That particular job you didn't do in a way that somebody thought was good enough. I remember walking home that evening, and the struggle wasn't that my paper wasn't good enough. The struggle was, am I good enough? Am I smart enough to go to college? Then you start telling yourself things too. I wasted a lot of money going to school. I don't even know why I'm doing this. This is so stupid. I'm going to go get a good job at 7-Eleven. You know, you start to tell yourself things. It's like, God never told me to go to school anyways. And my wife, I'm missing my wife and my new little baby. And this is so stupid. I am glad I got that bad grade because I'm dropping out. Because I don't feel like a masterpiece. And when I don't feel like a masterpiece, I start to feel like maybe I'm not good enough. And then I start to ask myself the question, can I cut it? And it's a small step. I can question a life plan. And you might be there today. You know where north is on your compass. You know what God's doing in your life. But then you hit a disappointment tied to something at the job or the workplace or school. And now everything's up for grabs. Masterpiece. I feel like a piece. Not a masterpiece. Out behind my place where I live, there's a field. And you know, I hear these stories on the internet, and I thought, what if I was walking out in that field, just think about it, or you were walking down that field, and you're walking along, and you see something that looks like a picture frame. And you run over and you grab it and you hold it up, and it's like an old picture, you know, you're looking at it, and all of a sudden you look down in the corner and it says Rembrandt. You know, one of those stories on the internet where somebody all of a sudden finds something, it's never you, but this time it is, you know, and you got this picture, like, no way! You know, and you find a Rembrandt out in this field, you know, and you hold it up, and as you look at it, and let's say that it was completely covered with mud, you could hardly see it, but it said Rembrandt down in the corner, you can hardly see it. How many of us would go, stupid things covered in mud, throw it aside and keep walking? No, you know, this is a masterpiece. My life has suddenly changed. You wouldn't let the mud bother you. But do you know, our jobs can throw a lot of mud. And part of God's job is to help us see ourselves through the mud and see other people through the mud and believe the promise it says in the Bible, I'm a masterpiece. I'm a one of a kind. I'll have my moments at the job. There'll be plenty of mud. And here's my problem. I get so caught up in the dirt. I get so caught up in the bad papers or the bad grades or I didn't sell as much as I was supposed to. I get so caught up in the mud, I can't see myself. And I certainly can't see myself like God sees me. And the tail starts to wag the dog. And when it does, you can think some pretty crazy thoughts and take some pretty poor turns. And next thing you know, you're a long ways away from where you're supposed to be. It's as silly as if you took that Rembrandt and said, this thing's caked with mud, and just threw it aside. And God has a plan for your life, and he's taking you somewhere, and there's a little mud right now, but could you allow him today to let you see through the mud? Because it'll always be there in some way or shape. Life at our workplace will create mud. But if you can see through it, if you don't let the tail wag the dog, if my job doesn't become the most important thing in my life, instead it's my relationship with God. Now the third thing, wind up this series, am I trying to erase my fears? And the reason that happens is because in the workplace, it's like my central place of provision and where my life is going. And so, you know, am I trying to erase my fears at the job? It's tied to my paycheck. And we really do think sometimes, if I can just stack up enough money, you know, if I'm prepared for anything that happens, who's ever had that thought? I mean, you know, what number is that, by the way? I'll be prepared for anything that comes my way. You know, what amount of money is that? How much do you stack up? What does your savings count need to be? Always more, of course. But how much would it need to be that you were prepared for anything? You're completely secure. Because I have enough money. Because I'm erasing all my fears with my job, where I get my paycheck. And then my paycheck becomes a tail that wags the dog until I run into something that money doesn't make the fear go away, like divorce or adultery or sexual abuse or violence, or I get fired or I get sick. And now I'm scared and I find out money doesn't make that fear go away. I'm still scared. See, money won't make fear go away. Love makes fear go away. And the strongest form of love is God's love. For God so loved the world that he sent his only son. Look at this part of the Bible. Here's how they put it. I said, I'm falling, but your constant love, circle that. Oh, Lord, held me up. Whenever I'm anxious or worried, you comfort me and make me glad. If I try to erase my fears because I have a paycheck and I get money, there's this great legend that's been told throughout church history almost from the time of Jesus. And there was this city, as the legend goes, that a plague broke out in. And so they station a guy at the gate at the city to warn people as they're coming in, and because there's this plague that's breaking out, which was really dangerous in those times, of course. No antibiotics or medication, so it's like a really, really big deal always. And there's this guy at this gate, and the angel of death shows up and starts to come through the gate. And this guy sees the angel of death. It's a legend. And he stops and he says, how many have you come for? And the angel said, I'm taking 1,000. And so he passes by and he goes into the city, and a week goes by. 1 week later, the same man is standing at this gate. And here comes the angel of death, and the man stops him. He says, you told me you were only taking 1,000. So many more than that died. Over 10,000 people died this week. You said you're only taking 1,000. And the angel of death said, I only took 1,000. The rest died because they were afraid. And I tell you that just to give you that's the power of fear. So there's no, I mean, we want to erase it, don't we? It's the reason why we go to work and pile up our money. We want something to hedge our fears. We don't want to be anxious and scared. We want to have something that goes, man, at least I've got this. And yet we find out, like I said, divorce and adultery, and I got sick, and someone rejected me, and I got fired. Money will not stop those fears. I had a friend named Andy Ross. My desk was here, there was a desk here, and then here was Andy's desk, and where I work at in sales. He was one of the best we had. He was awesome. And he got leukemia. So he had this huge fight with this leukemia, and he got through it all the way. He had the bone marrow transplant, and he got all the way through leukemia, and he was back at work, and he looked great. I mean, you just thought, he made it, you know, and he was just looking fantastic, and it seemed like it was going to be this great, happy story. And Andy was sort of an anxious guy. Super clever, intelligent, great with people, really neat sense of humor. But he ran a little on the anxious side. And he tended to stress out a little bit. You know, the deals wouldn't go just like he thought. Oh, my God, where's the tires? You know, and he just, it's the wrong color. You know, he's just kind of known as one of those guys. And I talked to him through the years, and one of the things he told me, he says, I've got a mortgage. I'm getting older. I feel like I'm where I should have been when I was like 25, and I'm almost 50. I'm so far behind. And he just had this anxiousness to him. There was lots of things that he was afraid of. So when you watched Andy go through his day, bless his heart, I mean, you just saw the anxiousness and the fear was just right there as he moved through his day. And then the leukemia came back. And he's in the fight all over again. And if you've been with someone through that, or you know what, it's a fight. And I was talking to Andy one day, and he said, he knew I was Christian. And he said, you know, I used to go to church when I was a kid. He went to this Christian church. He said, I was even an altar boy. Then I remember he was sitting in this chair, and he kind of looked off into the distance, almost like I wasn't there, saying it to me, but it seemed like he was saying it more to himself. Maybe you've seen that. He just said, I don't know why I ever quit. That was one of the best times of my life. And then he just moved on. And leukemia comes back. And he's in a big fight. He's not at work anymore. And I got a chance to see him one last time and talk to him one last time. And when I spoke to him, he said, "Hey, Robin, I went back to church." I was like, "Really?" He goes, "Yeah." He goes, "I went back. It wasn't my old church, but it was the same kind of church. I think it was an Episcopalian or something, I don't know, some kind of church." And he said, because I went back to church, and he looked at me and goes, it felt so good. And I remembered all that anxiety I was used to with him. And, you know, if you get freaked out over some tires on a car, you can imagine what cancer would do. I mean, he was high, strong, gone. It struck me so much, I was like, wow, what's up with you? And then the last time I spoke to him on the phone. You weren't able to go see him anymore, so you could just call, and I talked to him on the phone. I said, "How you doing?" And now he's paralyzed from the waist down, and it's not good. And he told me, he goes, "Gosh," and there wasn't a hint of anxiety in his voice. He goes, "Robin," he goes, "I'm miserable." Sometimes Andy would swear, so plug in your own word. He's like, "I'm miserable." He goes, "I can't take a crap, I can't pee." Because I'm paralyzed from the waist down. Not a hint of anxiety in his voice. No fear. And I'm thinking, Andy, I've seen you when you can't find your pin, you're about ready to have a nervous breakdown. And you're days away. No fear. Now, when Andy passed on a couple weeks ago, he passed on with no fear, no anxiety. He told me, he said, "I might make it or I might be gone." When he said that, no fear. See, please know this. Your job, your money, maybe you get an A on the test, maybe you get an F. Not strong enough. Tail's going to wag the dog. God's love, strong enough. Whatever scares you, whatever's causing you anxiety, maybe you're raising a teenager, that'll do it. You know, maybe your family is blended. Maybe they're reworking your job. Maybe you're getting older like Andy. You're like, "Oh man, I'm getting a late start." Maybe you're got stepkids and their kids and your kids and the other kids, and maybe trying to find your way back to Jesus and you don't know how he feels about you. Maybe you just come into this church and you're like, "Church in a movie theater? How weird." You know, it's like, your job can't be your Jesus, but Jesus will be your Savior. And look at the bottom line, is the choice that we can make as this series comes to an end. Will I let God be the boss of me? Put in a question. I hope you're riding high at work, but you might be riding low. Really doesn't matter if God is the boss of me. Listen to the Bible. Whatever work you do, teach, go to school, you're a coach, you're a plumber, you're a salesperson, you're a stay-home dad or mom, you cook in a restaurant, you serve food in a restaurant, you're going to get through school and do something completely different. Whatever work you do, do it with all your heart. Do it for the Lord and not for men. Remember that you will get your reward from the Lord. That's a promise. For everybody that failed this week, you will get your reward from the Lord. From everybody that got your A's this week, He will give you what you should receive. You are working for the Lord Christ. If He gets to be the boss, will I let God be the boss of me? It's the theme of the whole series.